This podcast was brought to you in partnership with Liz Earl Beauty Co. Hi, I'm Hannah, one of the co-founders at Go Jauntly, a walking and nature connection app. Welcome to season two of our podcast, Nature Bounce. This is our chance to banter with a series of inspirational people to talk about green living, walking, and well-being. Hello, listeners. Welcome to the final episode of season two. I can't believe we're here already. On today's episode, we'll be chatting to author, artist, and right-to-roam campaigner Nick Hayes. His new book, The Book of Trespass, is eye-opening and mind-blowing, to say the least. I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact by the law of trespass in England, we are excluded from 92% of the land and 97% of its waterways. The chapters Cow and Cockroaches are extremely heartrending and examine the plight of African slaves, the fact that British colonialists pretty much drained India of its GDP, and the harsh reality of the former residents of Calais jungle, which housed and detained people who were suffering and fleeing war, famine, poverty, and harrowing terror. The book is peppered with Nick's beautiful illustrations and his trespassing adventures, which help offer an essential moment or respite to pause and then swallow the deep insight and often untold history of land rights, land ownerships, and the right to roam. Thanks for being our guest today, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. Thanks for the lovely introduction as well. I appreciate that.
I'm glad you like it. I'm still sort of suffering from a couple of the chapters, particularly Cow and Cockroaches. But the history of trespass is quite long and quite disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're almost, we're almost due a 1,000-year celebration of being under the cult of exclusion, as I call it in the book. I think it dates pretty much back from William the Conqueror when he came over and conquered England, basically the southeast, really for the purpose of maintaining his deer stock that he liked to hunt. He was the first person to put fences up around a field, not to keep the cattle or the livestock in, but to keep the commoners and the peasants out. Those areas were known as forests, which is a word obviously we still have today. Nothing to do with trees as such, but just comes from the Latin forest, meaning out of. And these places that he created, these forests, were areas outside of the common law of the land, which meant that commoners weren't allowed their, the rights that they'd enjoyed for centuries, probably millennia before, which was, to sort of take your cows to pasture, make sure your pigs were well fed, take the wood and stuff. And with those, with this new rule of exclusion, William was able to dedicate the land entirely to the fattening of deer, whilst the entire rest of the population of England were excluded and unable to subsist, essentially unable to survive on what they'd become accustomed to. It kind of built from there, really, just a load of the Tudor times was another major period of exclusion, the Georgian era. And this was all buttressed by laws and theses and pamphlets that were essentially written by people who were supported by major landowners. So they were, as E.P. Thompson, the famous historian of the working class, said, that the law was able to don the robes of impartiality, but actually were just writing from a very biased and vested interest.
I was going to ask if there's been a concerted effort by landlords to put people off visiting the great outdoors. And I think just by what you said, it definitely started out that way and it seems to have just continued.
That's absolutely correct. And I've still never been sure whether the sort of fundamental cause of this was just finance. The more of the land you claim for yourself, the more you're able to do what you like with it, because those are the kind of the dominion of property allows you even to destroy that which you own by English law, or whether it was just a basic sort of human greed, like that sense that something is only yours if no one else can have it. And I still haven't really got to the bottom of that, even in my own head.
It's like this kind of overwhelming sense of entitlement that suddenly you can claim something to be yours. And then the aristocrats of England made their money by monopolizing the land and then using their elite definition of property rights to line their own pockets. And you mentioned them literally squeezing it until the money comes out, which is just such a kind of like graphic way of describing it. And it sounds like that's exactly what they did back then and probably what's happening now.
Oh, I mean, it's certainly happening now. The one of the great pantomime villains of the book is former MP Richard Bennion. And up until Rishi Sunak came to town, he was the richest MP in Parliament. And he owns about, he was interesting to me because he basically owns the land that I grew up on in West Berkshire. And he owns about 12,000 acres of West Berkshire in Hampshire. And I mean, he's just a very good example of what's going on now, compared to the rights that, the commoners used to own. There's a place called Bennion's Enclosure. His family, I think, have been landowners in the area for at least 500-600 years. And Bennion's Enclosure is quite a small area of land, that the commoners once had rights to, dig the gravel. For their building foundations, etc. From the early 1800s, his grandfather, his ancestor, fenced it off, passed a law of enclosure that sort of ratified the fence with lines of law and legislation. And currently, he's mining the gravel that lies underneath this ground, and all of that money is going to line his own pockets. And so the part of the book was trying to explain how once the rights or the wealth of the land was held in commonwealth, was held by everybody, and how just simply putting a fence around it and, you know, being in Parliament certainly helps to forge the laws in your own, you know, to your own benefit. Mm. All of a sudden, that wealth, that kind of access to the value of the land was enclosed and just went to one person's pocket alone. And the same is happening constantly and currently, but all across England. And it, you know, it involves the mining of tin and of coal back in the early days. And these days, I think, sort of translates into something that you might want to call like, you know, the wealth of mental health or the wealth mm-hmm. of physical health. Like, you know, we don't need the commons so much anymore to for our wood stoves or, you know, for our subsistence, for our food. Very few of us go out hunting, you know, and sort of crossbowing rabbits for our dinner. but actually, what we lack now is the space to really reap the benefits, both for physical and mental health. And actually, the repercussions of this have been shown day in, day out in the NHS, and even more so during lockdown, where currently England is facing what can only be called, you know, a mental health crisis, depression, anxiety, ADHD. And the evidence is undeniable, the scientific, empirical evidence of how a connection to nature really seriously improves our mental health and, of course, our physical health. So that's the value that we're lacking now. And really, there's no reason why that should be the case other than 1,000 years of orthodoxy and pretty much the same amount of time of vested interest. You know, like some of these major landowners have held their land since they were given it by William the Conqueror.
It's just so fascinating. I mean, you must have uncovered lots of little known facts about trespassing. Which historical fact has surprised you the most?
Oh, that is a good question. I think the thing that surprised me the most was how much I enjoyed the law side of it. You know, I bought, what is it, Wilfred and Jolowitz on Tort, because trespass resides under this kind of common law. grouping called tort, which is defined as harm and damage. And so it might include defamation or, you know, or libel, but also includes if you put your foot over the line of someone else's land, you're sort of said to damage them. And certainly getting into the law, I always thought that the law was, like a very sturdy scaffold that was, but it's not that at all. It's a very malleable, it's all down to interpretation. It's definitely down to how the judge, interprets what the lawyers or the barristers have presented. And it's much more mercurial than I think most people, well, certainly myself, I can't speak for anyone else but myself, but I always just assumed that the law was something, you know, like sort of carved in stone, but it's anything but that. And the interesting side of that is that obviously that means if it's open to interpretation, then it's open to change and mutability. And as ever, it just comes down to the people to basically to kick up enough fuss so that the law can be changed. And that's exactly what me and a few friends of mine are intending to do.
I'd love to find out a little bit more about the Right to Roam campaign that you're working on. But before we move on, I just wanted to pick up on a point you were talking about regarding the disconnection with nature. And in your book, you mention Octavia Hill, who was the social reformer and one of the founders of the National Trust. And she wanted the outdoors to become the people's outdoor living room. You mentioned this in the book as well. And it feels even more relevant now with the backdrop of COVID, like you said. And then in your book, you talk about this concept of a mind wall. I won't say it in German, which you helpfully translate for us, but it did make me wonder if this wall could explain the current root source of the disconnection that humans have with the rest of the natural world.
Well, I think so. I mean, that's definitely the thesis I put forward in the book. Really, I think on a day-to-day level, no one these days really sets out to go for a walk in the woodland and is deterred by the barbed wire or the wall itself. The point is that we don't even bother to go, you know, to set foot into that woodland because we know we have this sort of deep-rooted sense that it's not for us. And as I describe it in the book, this mind wall is centuries in the making. It's connected to The concept of trespass is a very, very strange one because in one sense, it's a very minor infraction and you can't be arrested and you won't be prosecuted for trespass alone. But on the other side, it's got this real sort of almost religious sense of immorality to it, that you're really doing something that is like deeply ethically wrong. And that's certainly how the gamekeepers that I encountered on the way, they're kind of shocked that you would have the gall to consider stripping off and swimming in a river just because you like the kingfishers that were there, when this river is owned by someone else. So deep is this orthodoxy that you can own a river or a wildflower meadow. And I think it's fair, actually, that there's a sense that ownership itself is not what excludes us. It's this total sense of dominion of how we define property in England that interestingly is defined completely differently up in Scotland, or rather their right to roam legislation from 2003 basically sort of prioritizes the public's right to access nature over the individual landowner's right to exclude them. So people still own the land, but they don't own the right to boot other people off. But it's this mind wall, it's this sense that we're doing something wrong, that this wall, this physical barrier has a legitimacy that supersedes the legitimate desire that we have to walk or swim or paddleboard or, you know, climb in nature. It's so deeply rooted in us that certainly for our campaign, that's one of the things we have to focus on to actually prove to people that the harm is not in the trespass, but in the law that defines walking in nature as an incursion or as a damage on someone else's self, really. Like property is considered in law to be an extension of the self of the landowner. So by me walking, you know, the Duke of Buccleuch's private gardens are 30 times larger than Hyde Park. And this sense that by taking a walk in one of the woodlands there, that I'm actively damaging the Duke of Buccleuch himself, is what's called a legal fiction in legal circles, but is also, you know, sort of roughly defined as a complete fantasy and an abhorrent, just a real, that's the core damage to our health and our mental health, is this sense that we're doing something wrong by doing what our bodies so desperately need.
Yeah. It's really helpful to hear you kind of relay that to me, because when I was reading the book, I guess there was this sort of feeling that actually maybe all of the reasons why I thought we were disconnected with nature, there are like increasing issues with people feeling like they can spend time outdoors or around representation and things like that. I guess I hadn't even really considered that, or I didn't even know that this is potentially like the real reason. It's not because like you're distracted with your phone, or there's like too many other things to do, you're watching Netflix, you're chilling and you're not going out and about. I guess there's that on the surface, but deep down it feels like actually, like you said, it's like slightly immoral potentially to sort of spend time in places where you don't know if you're allowed to be there.
Absolutely. But I think what you said is true as well. I think enclosure happened such a long time ago that we've forgotten what we've lost. If you went to Finland and Estonia or Scotland and you built a wall around one of the locks or the lakes, or you put a load of that kind of nasty iron, it's twisted at the top kind of fencing around a river in Finland, as you have in England, to protect the anglers and their sole dominion over the rivers, there would be a public outcry. Like the fences would be torn down, and people would be so, they'd find it so absurd that you could decide to own a river. But it's become so deeply embedded in what we consider to be normal that actually there's a public outcry, or, you know, the sort of spirit of the law is against people for trying to access a river. Really, what the book is trying to do is to sort of represent or to prove how actually it's the fence that causes the damage to society and not the climbing of it.
Today, I have my eye on one of the new routes added by our wonderful Go Jauntly community member, Nisbet Folk. It's called the Hungerford to Chiltern Foliot Walk, and it's a 10K circular route starting and ending in Hungerford in West Berkshire. Along the route, you walk through open fields and woodland, along rivers and canals, and you pass by a picturesque village church and country pub. It looks to me like the perfect walk for a sunny autumn Saturday. You can check it out at the link on our website or by searching Hungerford in app. In this episode, my app tip is sharing walks. If you create your own amazing route on Go Jauntly, or if you find an existing route that you really love, there is an easy way to share that with your friends, family, or anyone else. Just open the route in app, tap the tree menu in the lower right-hand corner, and select share. You can then send a direct link to the walk via text or email, or even post it on social media. Don't forget to tag Go Jauntly if you do.
So the passive apartheid phrase was, I think it was Trevor Phillips that called it that. And that was referring specifically to how uncomfortable people of colour feel walking through the English countryside, not least because there's a great deal of it was enclosed completely on the reparations and the money paid to slave owners when they gave up their property of these enslaved African human beings. But also because there's just so few people of colour in the countryside. There's a deep sense of just kind of unwelcomeness because people of colour don't see, faces similar to theirs when walking through the countryside. And actually people in the countryside don't aren't accustomed to seeing people of color, there's this sort of bizarre sense or sort of parallel in the English mindset that urban and black are kind of conjoined, whereas the idea of black and the countryside just isn't something, just doesn't reside in our consciousness, which is bizarre because, you know, many of the ancestors of these, you know, the diaspora that have come to England were, of course, farming communities and people that existed solely from the land. So it's a bizarre media. It's another wall that needs scaling. So specifically in terms of race, yeah, I would say the most dynamic and the most radical part of the land movement as it exists in England at the moment is specifically to do with reclaiming land as reparations for slavery. There's an amazing group called Land in Our Names, Lion, that are campaigning for land to be given or for people of colour to be given access to land for farming and for allotments and for food growing. Not least because these communities suffer from mental health problems in a disproportionate level to the rest of the community. And maybe that does have something to do with their lack of access and lack of feeling of welcomeness in the countryside. But the book itself, I'd hope, is full of positivity. It's full of, the sort of stories of Greenham Common, stories of the Liberate Tate, group stories. The fracking stories didn't actually, or the fracking protests didn't make it in, but the Sheffield tree protests, basically it's full of stories of Grow He Throw is there as well, and the amazing success they had with probably now blocking the third runway in Heathrow. A combination of direct action, a combination of squatting the land, combination of kind of community groups coming together, but also legal action, and all of these people coming together. Hopefully the book is the spine of the book is based on a positivity that actually direct action and community action really seriously does work. And one of the walls that the orthodoxy sort of erects to prevent that is this kind of sense that direct action or civil disobedience or protest is futile. And it absolutely isn't. It's just the way it suits the authorities to present it as such, simply because it sort of prevents more people, going out and doing it. But then if you look at Extinction Rebellion, whose work is also mentioned in the book, basically every human right that we've ever won has been claimed by the people and not given by the authorities. In a way, it's another one of these spells that I talk about in the book that kind of lulls us into believing that there's nothing we can do about it, because everything we've gained ourselves, and that nothing's been given to us. So hopefully the book is full of positivity, and then, yeah, with specific regard to the Right to Roam campaign, we've got very big plans, and we've got a lot of energy, and we've got a lot of time, I think, because the Conservative government has got another 4 years at least in power. So we're sort of building the architecture of a campaign that that we're very confident will just win, as long as we can persuade as many people as possible to join us, because that's really all it will take.
With Go Jauntly, what we're trying to do is unlock the hidden gems that people don't really realise that around them, within walking distance. I think that we tend to disrespect urban nature or don't put it on as high a plane as, say, walking in the great outdoors. So for us, the idea of championing local green space, championing local woodlands or nature reserves, or even like recreation grounds is a really, really important part of helping to connect people with the natural world on their doorstep.
I completely agree. Have you read Lucy Jones's book, Losing Eden?
I have, and she was on the podcast a few episodes ago. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Well, yeah, she's part of our campaign as well. We've become pretty good pals. And everything that I sort of felt and deeply believed in my gut about the link between mental health and physical health and a connection to nature is basically just catalogued in Lucy's book. And, you know, one of the points that stood out is just simply by walking through, you know, if you're on your way to work in the city, if you choose to walk through the park every day for 15 minutes, then your mental and physical health is improved by just that connection, just simply that connection to nature. And it's kind of exponential, you know, the more connection you have, just the more healthy you become. Our campaign is not calling for a full right to roam across England. We want to be a bit more reasonable than that, because I think the kickback against the full right to roam, similar to that in Scotland or Finland or Norway, would actually stall the campaign. What we want to do is we've highlighted four terrains in England, and that's woodland, that's rivers, that's downland, and most important to what we're talking about now is greenbelt, because these four areas can offer the public basically they're the closest terrains to the most amount of people, and 60% of English people live within easy access of greenbelt. So whilst it's important to sort of bolster the nature that is like within the city, it's also important to improve not just the access to the greenbelt, you know, bus services and train services, etc., but also to give us the right to walk on the verges of farmers' fields, as long as we cause no damage, as long as, you know, we follow Scotland's footsteps by talking about a responsible right to roam. We leave the gates as we find them. We put our dogs on the leads, you know, all of these kind of things. The way we see it, the only way that we can really learn a responsible connection with nature is by being given the right to actually connect with it in the first place. So for us, greenbelt is a very important part of that campaign, just simply because it will affect the most amount of people in England by opening that up. We FOI'd the government to find out how much exactly they'd spent on publicising the Countryside Code. And it turned out they'd spent £2,000 a year publicising the Countryside Code across England, which is a long way of saying bugger all. If you go walking in the countryside, you're going to see tens of no trespassing, no entry, private property, keep off signs. But not once are you going to see a sign informing you of, you know, how to treat the countryside with respect. So obviously, from our point of view, lockdown really brought to the fore this idea of the connection between social justice and mental health and connection to outdoors space. So that did a lot of the work for us. But also it highlighted just this devastating amount of destruction that was brought to the countryside, the litter, the vandalism. And so it sort of presented us with a challenge. Like, we've really, if we're talking about the, you know, access to the country, we need to also to bring landowners and farmers and just other people that love the countryside on board. We need to present a plan of how to deal with that litter. So the Countryside Code is a part of that. It's you know, it's just too weak. This sense that you shouldn't drop litter is fine and completely understandable, but it doesn't go far enough. We should valorize the collection of litter. And there's actually, there's, I mean, Surfers Against Sewage are the kings and queens of this, but an offshoot of Surfers Against Sewage is Trash Free Trails. They're another incredible organisation that just use community volunteers to meet up every week, go for a good mountain bike ride or a walk or a kayak, because British Canoeing, the association that represents canoeists and paddleboarders, they've also got about 70 schemes set up across the rivers of England, where people gather together, kind of a social event, and they go around and they just like rid England of litter. I don't see any reason, like, what we're going to be calling for is a kind of national rollout of those kind of schemes where, based on this old commoners code, that with the rights to the land come your responsibilities to the land, we need community groups of people that can basically guarantee farmers that they will be walking on their land at some point in the next month, and they will be doing so with gloves, hooks, or those grabby claw things, and bin liners, and they will, you know, they will not leave the land until they can't find any more bloody Lucozade bottles and Walker's crisp packets and stuff. That's the only way that we're going to be able to guarantee to landowners that an increase of people in the countryside will not see an increase of litter and destruction.
Yeah, I have a little bit of an issue with it being called the Countryside Code in a way, because actually we need to respect like the green spaces, the urban green spaces in and around us. I was talking to David Lindo, who's also known as the urban birder, in a recent episode. He was talking about how the way nature has been framed for us is that it's somewhere far away. So it's the plains of Africa, it's the Serengeti. And so we need to work to protect those areas. But what that means is that actually we don't necessarily like respect the nature on our doorstep. So you'll toss a McDonald's kind of packaging out your window, or you'll leave your face mask or your COVID swabs, as I found in a walk around a cemetery near me the other day. Like just around, because it doesn't matter, because either someone else will pick it up or it's not a part of the rest of the natural world. And so it feels like there needs to be like a basically like a nature code or something like that, and like this kind of mass education that by looking after your kind of immediate surroundings, you're actually helping to conserve the environment as well.
Well, I mean, I totally agree. We're, as a minor point, we're actually going to call ours the Commoner's Code, because we want this code to emphasize that it's everybody's responsibility to their local area. You know, it's all about localism. It's all about wherever you live, there has to be a sense of personal care. And what you were saying, there was something on the BBC website a couple of weeks ago that said exactly what you said, that this idea of, well, in Lucy Jones's book, she quotes a scientist called Michael Pyle that says, you know, what is the extinction of a condor to a child that's never known a wren? And it just puts it poetically, without a sense of, without a personal sense of connectedness to your local nature, how the hell are you supposed to care about this sort of wider, vast, devastating, you know, impossible to comprehend scale of destruction of the climate and the environment? We're definitely looking to emphasize each person's local personal responsibility to the countryside, to nature itself. And what you're saying about the urban environment and what the urban birder was saying, it also touches on what I sort of look at, this idea of the exoticization of nature. Like nature is something that is othered, it's distant, it's all that way away. And we can kind of revere it when we go around a National Trust property, or if, you know, the Earl of Carnarvon opens up his grounds for tax breaks once a year. We sort of go around and we marvel at the beautiful arboretum cedar trees. And, you know, we look at the Capability Brown little sort of Grecian pillar sort of shrine or folly that they might have put up. And we think, oh goodness, how lovely it is to be in nature. Mm. But actually, I mean, this is why I love rivers so much. Like, nature just forges channels right through cities and, you know, exists on our doorstep. This is what my hero Rob McFarlane was writing about in The Wild Places. You know, if you really want to see something wild, just look on your front doorstep and watch the weed crack through the pavement. Like it's all there in front of
song in the background. It's really nice.
What from you?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, thank God the bloody Canada geese have shut up for a second. they're usually honking over my head at around this point. I'm chatting to you on the River Thames at the moment in a marina just off Reading. 2 foot away, I could really experience nature by falling into the river. But
I feel like you might quite like that from some of your descriptions in your book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd be annoyed that I'd have to pay for a new phone.
Yeah, but, that's true.
Other than that, and my feet would get wet.
Yeah.
So the point of the book is not to encourage people to trespass. The point of the book is to encourage people to gather together under this Right to Roam campaign to change this definition of accessing nature as from something that is considered a crime or immoral to something that is no less than our birthright.
Mm. Great, fantastic. On that note, where can we find out more information?
Well, it's me and my buddy Guy Shrubsole, who wrote a book called Who Owns England that came out a year before mine. We've set up a website called righttoroam.org.uk, and we would love you and your listeners to go and sign up to that, because come next spring, that's when the mass trespasses will start. That's when the messaging will go out. That's when we really launch and go public with it. And basically, social movements work when there's lots of boots on the ground, and they don't work when people can't, you know, don't want to go out and campaign for it. So it's basically, it's us sort of pushing it, but it's entirely reliant on your listeners to join us and help us out. We would love their help.
Great, thank you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
If you haven't already, I highly recommend getting the Book of Trespass on your Christmas list for yourself and as a gift to others. It's really enlightening and will help you see the places you visit, both near and far, in a brand new light. Please do check out the Right to Roam website too. You can find it at www.righttoroam.org.uk. Thanks so much for listening into season two. I hope that you enjoyed the guests and the chat as much as I have. It's been a real highlight so far for us, and I'm amazed we've actually managed to pull it off given everything that's been going on this year. I owe a massive thanks to Shane, without whom this podcast would be impossible. And also a big thanks to Sam and Sarah, who've been beavering away behind the scenes. I'd also like to thank our inspiring guests and our amazing listeners. Thank you for tuning in and listening to our banter. I've really enjoyed learning more about the different pathways to nature connection and the blockers that we face. That's it from us for now. Please don't forget to rate and comment if you like the show. And take care. Feel free to get in touch and say hey at hi@gojauntly.com or over on our Twitter or our Instagram. This podcast was brought to you in partnership with Liz Earle Beauty Co.